This is Red Eyes Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren. RedEyesCreations.com is our website. We have frequently updated news, our radio archive, videos, films, links, resources, and much more. We are based out of Sweden, Scandinavia. We are here doing radio on Thursdays and Sundays with interesting guests, interviews, and information for your consideration. We do not tell you what to think or what you should believe. We try to present the information in the best way we can and help to highlight the research of authors, filmmakers, and other researchers and bring their information to your attention. And we think that you should make up your own mind about the subjects that we cover and always question the material, all the information, and of course continue the search for yourself if you find it interesting. I also want to remind you that our upcoming live show is on Saturday the 4th at 6 p.m. That's actually the universal time. We have Daniel Tatman on architecture, symbolism, and the history of Bath, England. Very interesting topic with Daniel Tatman. And go to our website, redeyescreations.com. Click on the Red Eyes Live banner. And from there, you'll be able to see the different time zones, depending on where you are in the world. So you can tune in live this coming Saturday. Don't miss it. Very exciting stuff. Okay, today we have Hugh Newman with us. We are going to talk about megaliths, ley line, earth energies, and much, much more. He's a earth mysteries and esoteric science researcher. He's the author of Earth Grids, the secret pattern of Gaia's sacred sites. He organizes the Megalithomania conferences. He co-edits Avalon Rising magazine and is the Earth Energies and Divinatory Arts Area Coordinator for the Big Green Gathering. Two of his main websites to check out is woodenbooks.com for his latest book, and also megalithomania.co.uk for the conference. He has also researched the Indigo Child phenomena firsthand and published a book on the subject. He's spoken at conferences in the UK, Malta, and South America. And he's a honorary member of the Antiquarian Society. And we have a few more websites that we want to give out later on so you can continue to dig into some of the work of Hugh. So with that, thank you very much for coming on. Nice to have you on the program, Hugh.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Brilliant. You know, I want to begin and just talk briefly a little bit about your background for people that are not familiar with you or your work. So tell us just about some of the areas that you've been going into and for how long you've been researching this stuff.
One of the first more esoteric things I got into was researching the indigo children or the psychic children, which I also got a book published about that last year as well. It was really, you know, from Drungvlo Melchizedek's work that triggered that area of research. And eventually I went to this this conference in Hawaii, the Psychic Children Speak to the World conference, and met up with some of them there and got completely blown away by what was going on. They showed me stuff about the earth grid and about how ceremonies on it can influence certain things and etc. And it kind of triggered a whole area of research. A little while before that, I read the book called The Sun and the Serpent by Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, which put a whole new perspective into the nature of landscapes and history and about how energies and ley lines and so forth move around the planet. And eventually this culminated in a huge amount of research I did for this book about Earth Grids, which has recently come out on Wooden Books. But also, along with the psychic kids research, I studied nutrition quite deeply, naturopathic nutrition, and learn a lot about how our children and adults really are being affected by the lack of minerals and lack of nutrition in the food supply. And I'll present about that as well. But that's recently actually come together into my latest megalithic research, which links how ancient sites were used as like fertility generators and could enhance seeds and agriculture. And also how rock dust was used, which is the same type of rock as the megaliths, put on the land and help grow food and remineralize the food supply. So all these sort of ancient sciences are kind of linking up, you know, with nutrition and with the fairly new science of understanding earth energies. So there's a whole load of stuff that I'm into, really.
Very interesting. And why don't we go back, so to speak, then talk about some of the early period, so to speak, of Earth. How far back do you think we have to go to the Stone Age, vicinity, so to speak, or the Neolithic era? Where do we begin here, so to speak?
Well, with the Neolithic, you know, when we look at the megalithic sites, we're really talking about roughly 5,000 years ago, you know, but right. between about 7,000 and 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, there's quite a large area of time we're dealing with here. But what discoveries that are being made recently is that the dates seem to be going further and further back. There's lots of sites around the world. The Bekele Tepe, for example, has been discovered in Turkey, is over 9,000 years old. There's talk about these pyramids in Bosnia. Now, they're extremely old, possibly going even older than that. Baalbek in the Lebanon as well. The huge megaliths there, and various researchers like Anthony Avini, who are archaeoastronomers, who are dating places like Tiwanaku in Bolivia back to 17,000 years. So there's lots of debate about the age of these sites, but what we're finding is that it seems to be that the sort of known older sites seem to be the more sophisticated, sort of carried the higher wisdom, as though it kind of came from somewhere else, and it appeared in its sort of present, quite high status form. We get the same thing even, you know, with Egypt and the legends of Osiris. And this, you know, when we start, as we start going further back, it's harder to find, you know, hard to prove things, either through carbon dating. But one of the best ways, really, is to look at the old myths and legends from all around the world. And there seems to be talk of this sort of higher culture. Some people like to call it Atlantis and so forth, but we don't know about Atlantis. It hasn't been found yet, so we can't prove that. But there seems to be some higher culture and legends of these people who travelled the world, who are very tall, seem to have long white beards, bright blue eyes, are white people, which is quite fair-skinned, and wore robes and taught the arts of civilization, marriage and peace, and these sort of higher values, which seem to go all around the world. We have Viracocha, who went, you know, to Bolivia and Peru, Quetzalcoatl in Mexico and Guatemala, Osiris in Egypt, the Tuatha-De-Nannan in Ireland, and so on and so forth. This has been covered by various researchers, but there seems to be a kind of dead end to the research. We can't seem to kind of find out exactly who these people were and where they came from. But a lot of people talk about the Middle East, and Edmund Marriage, who's been on your website and your show as well, talks about the higher culture in the Lebanon, kind of Turkey, sort of garden, you know, talking about the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
Which I find fascinating, and that's where a lot of the source of this knowledge seems to be traced back there.
Mm. Do you think that we're talking about a global culture here? Because again, it's very kind of wide dispersed across the planet, and many of the sites that you did mention, they're basically across the globe, you know?
Yeah, this is the other thing that gets me as well. I mean, this is one of the sort of key points in the Earth Grid's book, actually, is the idea that there's so many similarities, especially of the construction of sacred sites, ancient sites. We have dolmens all around the world, you know, dolmens are like, they're like got a roof slab on them with two or three large slabs holding it up like a table.
Mm.
And these are found all around the world. They're found in Turkey, they're found in England, Wales, even in Japan and China. And so there seems to be some kind of, and they're all the same design and style and so on and so forth. Even in, you know, near New York, there's some as well, and in America. So there's lots of different places. And then there's the classic thing with the pyramids all around the world as well. There seems to be similar construction, similar measurement systems they seem to have been using. And the research I've been doing is the placement of these major megalithic sites is how they connect around the world into very harmonic distances apart from each other. And sort of fractions apart from each other, and even geometries, which hence the idea of an Earth grid. So definitely some kind of, there seems to be some kind of global understanding that, and it looks like, you know, from my research and what other people have said, that the Earth was surveyed and it was mapped in very early prehistoric times, possibly before 10,000 years ago.
Hmm. Very interesting. And what about some of the ways or the method that some of these places, how they potentially were built? Do you think that kind of goes hand in hand with the knowledge of energy and also the Earth energy, of how to utilize that in some way?
Yeah, I mean, what do you mean, like very large megalithic constructions?
Sure, pyramids, or even, you know, we talk about, you mentioned Baalbek, for instance. I mean, these are the Trilaton down there. I mean, these are huge, you know, stones that are being quarried, and it's impossible for us today to even imagine how to lift one of these things.
Yeah,
you know?
this is one of the deeper mysteries of the megalithic era. Really, this is one of the kind of a lot of people just can't quite crack. And there is ideas that there are legends when you look back in, you know, into the whole Ireland and Wales to build Stonehenge. And he levitated them and he pushed them along effortlessly, as though they were floating. In South America, in Peru and Bolivia, we have the legend of Viracocha, or Contiki Viracocha, depending on which source you're looking at. And again, he was, the stories there, and this is from some of the stories received from David Hatcher Childress, actually, one of his remarkable books about South America, and how they would summon lightning, and this would create a sort of energy which would enable the stones to be lifted. So they seem to have something to do, you know, with electromagnetic kind of control. You know, somehow these ancient sort of wizards, if you like, could sort of manifest this. There's also, look into modern times, we have Coral Castle in Florida, which was built single-handedly, apparently, by a small five-foot Latvian called Ed Lidskalnin, who constructed this huge megalithic village, which you can still go and visit. And again, people question how could he have done that, because the tools he had there were very primitive. And he said, you know, he actually once wrote, or he said that he'd taken the secret to the pyramid builders to his grave. So that was kind of the last remaining kind of person or piece of knowledge about the construction techniques that went with him, unfortunately, when he died in the sort of 1950s.
And I think you relayed one of the stories there about Ed. In one of your lectures, you talked about the idea that he got a stone delivered and asked the... Well, you tell the story, right? Didn't you talk about that, how he managed to lift a stone from the truck while the truck driver was away?
Yeah, there's quite a few good stories about Ed Lidskalnin. I'm actually going to go over there in November to kind of check out Coral Castle, and I'm completely baffled by the way he did it. But one of the stories is that he had... sometimes he got trucks to bring up from the quarry down the hill from him. Very large megalithic block, somewhere up to about 40 tons. And they would bring it up in a truck. And one story is that the truck driver nipped out around the corner to have a cup of tea. And the stone was still on the back of the truck, this sort of 15-ton stone or whatever. And he came, when the driver came back, the stone was off the truck and standing upright on the floor next to Ed Lidskalnin, like about 2 minutes later. And he hasn't got a clue, and he was completely sort of dropped his cup of tea, apparently, and had no idea how it happened. So again, we're looking at a very simple yet sophisticated, you know, understanding of construction techniques going way back into antiquity. And in modern times, obviously, you know, when you've got the Freemasons, they're obviously interested in this kind of stuff as well, about trying to crack the kind of secrets of either anti-gravity or just being able to move massive amounts of weight.
Yes. If we talk about the Coral Castle, that's in, as you mentioned, in Miami, in Florida. Do you think that location also could be very important in regards to how, you know, he could have done this, so to speak?
Yeah, there are stories about that. I mean, I do mention that in the Earth Grid's book, actually. It's quite near a major grid point, according to the grid sort of systems that I've been looking at. But what is more likely, in my opinion, which is simply my opinion here, that is, and also this is influenced by the work of Christopher Dunn, who looked at the way the pyramids was used as a sort of high technology, was that something to do with magnetism, or some secrets of magnetism. So you could have an area of the landscape. There are vortexes around the world. There's quite a few in North America, for instance, where there's gravitational or magnetic anomalies. And if you can work with magnetism in such a way, then you should be able to lift stones if they have metallic or magnetic qualities about them. So again, how that was done is still a mystery, and that is one of the, you know, like I say, one of the mysteries that is still to be cracked. I mean, the Christopher Dunn idea is that somehow he worked with the magnetic flow lines or the telluric energies, and he was able to build up a charge in the stone which opposed the magnetic lines that were coming from a certain direction, especially at sunrise, you get this as well. So if you're opposing it, you remember at school, if you get two magnets and they oppose each other, one of them sort of floats above the other one.
Yeah.
The same kind of principles as that. And so, but again, how he did it, when you look at all the tools he's got there, it's just like a sort of bizarre kind of workshop full of tools at Lidskalnin's sort of little village, Coral Castle. So it's, again, people, no engineers or scientists have been able to quite work out how he did it. So, again, I quite like the idea that there's a mystery still there.
Yeah.
And there's still something to be, you know, worked out, even by very, you know, people, very clever people haven't worked it out yet.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. And You know, I'm also thinking about what potentially could happen over sea, because in many cases we talk about what you know, how these lines crisscross and how they influence, so to speak, the properties of the land. But if we move kind of further south and a little bit more towards the east, we have basically, you know, the Bermuda Triangle right down there in that vicinity as well, you know, outside Florida. What do you think, that there could be any relationship to the Earth energies in regards to some of the, you know, mysteries, if you will, surrounding that area?
I'm absolutely sure there's something going on there, because this goes back to the early 70s, actually, the work of Ivan Sanderson, who was researching the Bermuda Triangle and various, you know, he was like a mysteries researcher. He was also a biologist, I think, as well. And he noted through lots of statistical analysis that there were quite a few areas around the planet, mainly in the sea, which he later called Vial Vortices, where there's stories of vanishing aircraft, time dilations, mechanical instrument malfunctions, unexplained disappearances, and obviously lots of lives being lost. One of these, obviously, is the Bermuda Triangle, which is just off the coast. It just sort of contains Bermuda, sort of near Puerto Rico and the Bahamas, and so forth. In his article in 1972, 12 Devil's Graveyards Around the World, he noticed there was, you know, they all seemed to sort of fit, all harmonically spaced apart from each other. When you look at the picture, you immediately recognise it if you look at that on a 3D globe, that we're looking at an icosahedron, and all the sort of points or vertices of an icosahedron at the centres of these different triangles where strange things have happened all around the world. You get the Devil's Triangle is quite a famous one off the coast of Japan. There's even areas of strange occurrences around Hawaii where another point is. And obviously you've got the North and South Poles where you know, which you basically can't go to anymore. No one really knows what's going on at the North and South Poles directly there. So there's a huge mystery lying within that. But what Ivan Sanderson really discovered was really the first signs of a planetary grid at work, where there was something going on a certain type of geometry, i.e. the icosahedron, on the points of that geometry. That is just absolutely fascinating, and he kind of helped open up this whole scenario about Earth grids and the idea of how they could function on the planet.
Yes, so if we go kind of with that basis that there is a grid across the globe, then we can kind of, you know, go a bit forward, so to speak, into this Neolithic era, and then we can, you know, potentially say then that the people back then were in tune with where this grid was positioned, where it was, how it was laid out, and even potentially then how to use it or gain advantage from that. Because you mentioned earlier that the sites around the world are connected. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about that, what the kind of the relationship are between some of the megalithic sites in the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we just start with the grid, for example, I mean, William Becker and Beth Hargens, who've done lots of remarkable research about Earth grids, they found on a particular one, which is a combination of all the different platonic solids, but fundamentally it's based upon the icosadodecahedron, a combination of them, which is actually the one they work with because of the shape of the Earth, etc. It's a rhombic triacontahedron, for any kind of nerds out there who want to know that. And they say there's 3,300 sacred sites upon that particular grid alone. There are not many particularly marked major node points where these lines of energy cross, but that amount of sites alone really opens up a huge plethora of ideas. And other ways to look at that is the relationship between sites across the planet. And we did quite a bit of research on that for the book. And I sort of looked back at the research of John Michell, Robin Heath, John Neal, and various other people, and looking at ancient metrology, surveying in ancient times, and how there seems to be a high understanding of the size and shape of the Earth in prehistoric times. Mm-hmm. And again, when we look at the ancient maps, which Charles Hapgood fortunately managed to decode, he again came to the conclusion that not only was there a very advanced prehistoric mariner civilization going way back into antiquity, but the poles are even in different places, which a lot of sites seem to be related to the old poles as well. I'm just trying to think of the I think one of the key points really is one of the key sites for me is Avebury. Not only because it's sort of fairly local to me, but because it's got so many anomalies associated with it. It completely blows me away, and the placement of that alone, just when we look at that compared to like the pyramids and the equator and so forth, is remarkable. So, for example, Avebury is exactly, you know, we're talking absolutely exactly, the centre of Avebury is exactly 1/7 of the distance around the planet from the equator. So we're looking at, to be precise, I think it's 51 degrees, 25 minutes, 25 minutes, 43 seconds. But that's basically 360 divided by 7. And so so they were obviously working from the equator to survey the planet. And, you know, just a few, you know, sort of bizarre examples is that, like, Luxor is, if we imagine a quadrant of the planet, a quarter of the planet going from the equator to the North Pole, Luxor, or the ancient city of Thebes, sits at 2/7 of the quadrant distance, and Avebury sits at 4/7 of the quadrant distance up from the equator. So they seem to be sort of have some understanding of working out latitudes going north and south around the planet. And this is evident in Delphi as well, in ancient Greece. Delphi, Delos, and Dodona. Each of them is exactly 1 degree apart, and these were ancient oracle centres of the ancient Greeks, which they believed stretched back sort of into prehistoric times as well. So we're not just looking at sort of different eras with the same kind of high technology, sort of high understanding of the world. With Avebury as well, it sits the distance between Avebury and Newgrange is a 1/100th of the planetary circumference. Well, so there's lots of you know, we're talking not necessarily going north and south, but going all different directions around the world.
Right.
Avebury seemed to be at the centre of a lot of activity in the ancient world. There's a whole load more than that. I mean, John Martineau's written this remarkable little book about Avebury, and goes into it in much more detail. But it's just a huge amount going on about the positioning of sacred sites.
So it's a relationship in regards to ratios in relationship to the different sites. I mean, there is even people who have done, we don't necessarily have to go off planet in this program, but I know there's people who have even done correlations with the Cydonia region on Mars and Avebury, for instance.
Yeah. There's people who've sort of got a map of the Avebury region and placed it upon the sort of Cydonia region and found interesting correlations, but I think they are different sizes though. I think, if I remember correctly, they're quite different kind of sizes. They're not exactly the same.
Right.
I haven't really researched that part myself, but I know with Mars, we have the Olympus Mons volcanoes. They sit at 19.5 degrees above the equator. And we find that kind of latitude evident on lots of different planetary systems as well. For example, on the Sun, we have sort of major sunspot activity at 19.5 degrees above and below the equator. We have other planets have similar anomalies. For example, Jupiter, the Great Red Spot, a lot of people thought that was at 19.5 degrees, but we had another look at that and checked that out and found that that's at 22.5 degrees below the equator, which again is a quarter of a quadrant distance from the equator to the pole. So that's significant in itself. There's also a great dark spot on Neptune that once had a thin band of clouds going around it, which was photographed by NASA. And weirdly, a few months later when it was re-photographed by NASA, the dark spot in the clouds had moved 22.5 degrees below the equator. In a bizarre, so it looked, it may have had a magnetic pole shift or a pole reversal, which moved energetic upwellings at these latitudes from above to below the equator. There's a huge amount of stuff going on in our solar system, which a lot of people tend to not really have a look at. I mean, one of the things that gets me is this on Saturn, on the north pole of Saturn, there's a massive, great hexagon.
Yes.
energetic hexagon on there. And you can see it, you know, this has been known about since 1981, but no one's really picked up on it, apart from people like Richard Hoagland, who discovered all the Mars stuff. And what it does, it kind of holds its energy there. It doesn't budge. It stays absolutely still. And all the cloud bands kind of move around it, and they don't actually, it doesn't budge. So there's like some kind of cymatic, you know, energy upwelling there, which maintains its geometry and in this form. So we can see from other planets that there must be something like this going on Earth.
Yes.
Probably
yes.
Going into the entire cosmos, there's this great geometry, I think, which is, you know, understandably one of the principles of the universe and of creation.
Absolutely. I think that's fascinating. I think that story that you mentioned about the Saturn hexagon was kind of revamped and brought back to at least my attention again. Just I don't know if probably a year ago, a little bit less perhaps, when the Telegraph newspaper were you know writing about it again. It's absolutely fascinating, and I think that there, you know, that there is, you know, the question of course is that how that there must be a relationship between the planet and that the planet have these kinds of you know, when energy either coming in or energy existent on the planet, a property of that is that things align themselves, the energy align themselves in these different geometrical patterns. It's very difficult to explain that, of course, why that would be or even why they would take the shape that they do. But some have even proposed that the universe is the shape of a dodecahedron and things like that. So everything is kind of mirrored, you know, down on the smaller levels from that big level, so to speak.
One of the things that was actually in the press recently was this whole idea of dark matter, and I think it was about a year or so ago it came out. It was sort of came out in the newspapers, and then got kind of forgotten about fairly quickly, and other theories kind of taken over. But one of the things that interested me was the idea that the dark matter theory is that it forms an invisible scaffold or skeleton throughout the universe, and then within this skeleton, the universe is formed. And this was you know, put out there by cosmologists and you know scientists and so forth,
yeah.
And that came out in the Independent in actually the 8th of January 2007 to be precise.
Hmm.
But to me, that's an echo of the planetary grid. There's some kind of grid there which could be linked with dark matter, which could have even been there before the Earth. But you know, from where I'm from, I think it's just connected with the Earth, and it enables life to flourish within that. And so we see that in different scales, from the universal to the earthly scale to the human scale. And then when we start looking into cells and bacteria and viruses,
yes,
we start seeing a similar geometry. So it's the principles throughout creation.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's a fascinating thing about this, that you can, again, you can look upward, so to speak, to get knowledge about what is down into matter, so to speak. And if you look down, you can get a hint of what is above, you know. It's fascinating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
With ancient sites as well, and especially when you start looking into the surveying principles of ancient sites. I mean, Robin Heath, who's sort of, you know, done some remarkable research in Britain, has discovered that the four station stones at Stonehenge are the outer four stones that used to sort of, they form like this sort of a rectangle. If bisected in half, it creates what's called the lunation triangle, which when enlarged 2,500 times stretches across the landscape and touches Lundy Island, which is where which has many connections with Stonehenge, and also the Preseli Bluestone site where some of the stones from Stonehenge came from.
Mm-hmm.
And he's found this, and all the measurements fit in with precise ratios within Stonehenge itself. So it looks like they were doing very large surveying in ancient times, and it was so advanced that we haven't quite worked out exactly how they did it, unless they had technology like we have today.
Hmm.
So this kind of stuff just really gets me. It's not really been noticed by archaeologists and geologists and researchers.
Fascinating. And, you know, one thing we can talk about is some of the Earth chakra points, or even some of the, I guess, because I think you showed in one of your lectures too, that there is potentially, this is a theory then, I guess, that there are kind of two main energetic lines of the Earth, and that scattered throughout these are some of the main chakra points of the Earth. Is that, do I understand things correct?
Yeah, that is correct. This is the original, originally this was kind of visioned out by a guy called Robert Kuhn. He's done some amazing work around the world, and he was very into the idea of the Earth having chakras, and I think a lot of people kind of agree with him on this.
Mm-hmm.
It stemmed originally from the work of Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, again, who discovered the two great energy lines weaving around the St. Michael axis that goes across southern Britain, that from East Anglia all the way to Cornwall, and it's the longest part of southern England you can actually have, and there's a straight line alignment that goes along them. They found these two great energy lines weaving in and out of them, and suggested, even in their early research, that it was these were global currents of energy. And they even discovered them continuing up in St. Petersburg in Russia. So this was then sort of, you know, furthered really by Robert Kuhn, and he believed there was a great energy current that extended all around the planet and met back up with the St. Michael line again. But then he also said there was another one, which which he called the Plumed Serpent. The first one he called the Rainbow Serpent, because it went through Ayers Rock or Uluru in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was the Plumed Serpent. The reason it was called that is because it went through Lake Titicaca, Palenque, etc., and Mount Shasta, and so forth. And there's, in the Americas, there's legends of Quetzalcoatl and Viracocha, the Plumed Serpents, who wore these feathered robes and so forth. And when you look at it, you know, on a globe, it's like two kind of great earth circles, really. They're not perfect circles. They kind of weave around a little bit, like energy does.
Mm.
But they sort of encompass all these amazing sacred sites. Recently, a guy in Glastonbury, a friend of mine called Tor Webster, he's been researching this thoroughly. You can check out his website at rainbowserpent.co.uk. And we kind of keep in touch, and we kind of, you know, follow each other's research. But one thing that interested me is that both these major energy currents, which looks like there's sort of two little energy currents going around each one, but they cross in Lake Titicaca in Peru on the Island of the Sun.
Yes.
So I had an opportunity to go there last year and to find out if this was the case. And obviously Peru is a major megalithic area. It's amazing. The sheer magnitude and the stories of the megalithic societies way back in that part of the world. And on the Island of the Sun in Lake Titicaca, I discovered some megaliths on there, and it was right where this major energy line went through, and I sort of doused it, and I kind of, I've been sort of trained in geomancy so forth. It needs to be tested, I think, a bit more scientifically as well, perhaps. But I found the Michael line going through it, and the extension of the Michael line, or the Rainbow Serpent going through it, and found where it did actually cross on the island. So, you know, what Robert Coon originally visioned out back in the sort of late 80s and early 90s, I've helped verify through, you know, going there and finding them. And there's lots of links with these energies with fertility as well. And I mean, as you saw on the lecture that I did on that DVD, the energy line goes through this great frog, massive great frog effigy, which Incas revere as a fertility symbol. So again, we find these relations with earth energies and fertility, which is a whole other area of research we can have a look at a little bit later on, perhaps.
Yes, definitely. And you know, you mentioned Avebury, of course. What are some, you know, other of your, I guess, favorite sites? This thing with Lake Titicaca is fascinating, I think. But you talked about, for instance, Wormwood Hill in England, right?
Yeah, that's actually Wandlebury. That's just near my hometown of Cambridge, where I was born and bred. And Wandlebury is like an ancient earthwork. It's like a ring, like a henge. It's like the outer henge of Stonehenge, or the henge of Avebury without the stones, just with a large circular, perfectly circular ditch. And the Mary Line, which is one of the two major energy currents that weave around the St. Michael Line, goes right through that. And also we have an artificial mound, which is built in ancient times, just next to it, called Wormwood Hill. And that's also, you know, another name for that has always been the Dragon's Barrow. And dragon, we know, is related, some people believe, is related to these earth energy currents, dragon paths, and that we get in China and so forth.
Yes.
And that has got some very strange things happening there. There's been lots of people who've had out-of-body experiences and visions there, and it's never been excavated either, which intrigues me, that they then kind of dig in and see what's underneath it. But it looks almost like a sort of conical pyramid. It's quite large as well. Nothing like the sort of magnitude of Silbury Hill. But Wandlebury is, you know, that's another book I'm researching at the moment, actually. It's, and it has global implications, although it's very much about a local area, the whole landscape around Cambridgeshire and Essex. And there's even a grey ley line that goes from Wandlebury all the way down into Essex, which is 26 miles long, and goes through many, many different megalithic sites and barrows and stones and hill forts and mounds and so on. And it's all aligned with astronomical, very precise astronomical events, and which is part of the research that Edmund Marriage is involved in, and his auntie and uncle, Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien.
Yes.
Again, what we're seeing with Wandlebury, which the archaeologists, and this is a similar principle in lots of other sites around the world, is that the archaeologists and historians believe it's just maybe a couple of thousand years old. It's like an Iron Age hill fort. But what people, they've not been able to date anything there specifically. They found Neolithic finds there. They found Iron Age finds. So they're kind of being conservative and placing all these sites at a much sort of a more reasonable date than they actually are. And just when you look at the astronomy of the site and the way it was used as an Astronomical Observatory, you can date it back quite accurately, and this is what the O'Briens did. And again, we're looking at the same period of Stonehenge and Avebury, way over in Cambridgeshire. So again, you know, through researchers like myself and people like Robin Heath and lots of other people I'm involved with, there's a group called the Antiquarian Society, the Stuart Mason and so forth down in Sussex, we're really re-establishing the antiquity and sort of importance of these ancient sites, which are often overlooked just as some bizarre Iron Age hill fort. So this principle of research needs to be addressed all around the planet, I think, to put some of these sites back on the map into their original context.
Yes, indeed. You know, what I'm thinking of also here is when you mentioned a little bit some of the experiences that some people have on these sites, out of body, they see, you know, orbs or lights even. Some even have, you know, what could be termed as UFO sightings, meaning basically unidentified, you know, flying object or whatever. And, you know, could it be that this in some way also is so, it's affecting, you know, the human brain very much? And I'm not trying to kind of discredit the experiences people have, rather kind of emphasize it that there really is something going on there, but it could be something internal or a relationship with the site itself, but that it could actually energetically affect a human being who walk into this field of energy.
Absolutely. I mean, another aspect of that is modern versions of crop circles, which I'll talk about in a moment. But one of the things that's been discovered at these sites, as many of these sites, not necessarily all of them, is that the earth energies there are very prominent, and it's only really been taken seriously in the last sort of decade, really, the idea that these earth energies were manipulated and harnessed by the ancients for an unknown purpose. And one of the so this has been really kind of put back in the framework as a proper sort of study by Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst with their research on the St. Michael line and the energies associated with that. And there is evidence that people do have these very strange sort of phenomenon happening to them. And one of the things that's been discovered by John Burke and the BLT research team in America is that it's often where there's what's called a conductivity discontinuity. This is where one piece of geology under the ground sort of changes into another one and flips back and forth. And there's a weird kind of change in geology, basically. And what happens is these telluric lines, or these earth energy lines that are formed by the magnetic field of the planet, they kind of drop, that they kind of have electrical charge, hence the name telluric, generally going through them, but or they're magnetic. It just depends on the geology they're moving through. It's quite a complicated study, this, and I've had to do a lot of reading on this to try and work this out. But generally, where there's this conductivity discontinuity, there's this drop in magnetism of the lines, and this creates electrical charge, and this electrical charge is seen as balls of light or orbs, and this has been noted at many, many sacred sites, especially they find in the mornings when the sun's rising and the magnetic field changes and forms into these lines. Also at dusk, and even at other times, there's strange magnetic anomalies happening at certain sites. And it's not really a kind of a simple theory you can put on all of the sites. There seems to be a lot of interesting different things going on, but again, it's related to this magnetism. And one of the things they found with these energies, when there's this drop in magnetism, and there's high electrical charge, it affects consciousness.
Yeah.
And, for example, in North America, there's lots of vision quest areas and sites, which are still revered as sacred by the native tribes there to this day. And they've held on to them, a lot of them, which is very good. And the same thing's happening there. From a scientific perspective, there's a conductivity discontinuity where the energies, magnetic energies drop. There's this electrical charge. People have these amazing experiences. And this is the same as Wormwood Hill. So I think this is one aspect of it. This is one aspect of work, how the ancients worked with these energies it's kind of like a shamanic perspective, really. But there's also much more practical purposes as well, such as working with these energies to enhance seeds and fertility and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, what I hear a little bit you're describing there basically is different, a form of plasma, if you will. And I mean, some people even have theorized that energy in itself actually is can contain consciousness, meaning that a site like this that have the property of when the magnetics drop, energy flood in, so to speak, and that could actually fill this void right there with some kind of other consciousness. But what I find interesting as well is if you look at some of the Neolithic artwork is that often depicted are these kind of spirals or orbs and whatnot that very much look like a basically like a depiction of some of these phenomena that that we've been talking about here.
Absolutely. I mean, these spirals you get these all over the world. You get double spiral symbolism, triple spiral symbolism, and so forth, which you know is being carved on many ancient sites, literally all around the planet. Again, we see with the dolmens and the pyramids, there's a global kind of understanding. And so what these represent is still really a mystery. But one idea is that they do represent the telluric lines of force, which kind of move within sacred sites. One of the things I've discovered, you know, is that when I go to a site, I kind of go there, you know, quite open-minded with a dowsing rod in hand, just to see where these telluric lines move. And what they seem to do is they bounce off the walls. If there's a chamber there, if there's a stone circle, they bounce from one stone to another.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the stones are placed to sort of control the energy and keep it within a certain site. And often they turn into spirals. I think naturally they want to go into spirals, these telluric lines. And perhaps this was being noted and recorded by the ancients. And it's just one idea. I'm not sure if that's, you know, I'm not saying that's it, but
sure.
One idea, because this has been, I've found this at lots and lots of different sites. Now, other researchers have said the same.
Mm.
So there could be something there.
Fascinating. And, you know, before we break here in a little while, in about 5 or so minutes, for the next segment in our member section, I do want to talk a little bit more about your book, of course, called Earth Grids, The Secret Pattern of Gaia's Sacred Sites. Tell us a little bit more about some of the material that you discuss or write about in your new book.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, initially it's like a sort of history of Earth Grid research, and the idea, there's lots of, if you start looking at the myths, legends, kind of creation stories, we find evidence that they seem to have an idea of how the Earth was formed was linked with a kind of grid-like crystallized structure, and this is what the Hopi creation myth even speaks about. This, or one of the Hopi creation myths anyway, which you can find anywhere on the internet. It's also a big thing about it in the book. And also, when we look back at the Book of Enoch, they talk about great surveys of the planet, and that's kind of again possibly Neolithic era again. So we look at kind of we go way back and looking at this kind of stuff, and then we come bring it up to the modern sort of day from the 60s onwards. We look at the work of Bruce Cathy and how he discovered grid systems over New Zealand, which bizarrely was linked with UFO flight paths and sightings.
Mm-hmm, really?
And he plotted the grid from that entirely and came up with this grand idea of a global grid, which still a lot of people still stand by to this day, which has got a lot of validity. In the 70s, we had Ivan Sanderson, who came up with the Via Vortices, the icosahedral grid theory. Same time that was happening, we had three Russian researchers, I'm not even going to try to say their names on the radio, who came up with similar principles to Sanderson, but they worked with the dodecahedron, which is a 10-sided platonic solid. And they linked that, and then they placed an icosahedron over that and found that when they aligned the edge of the dodecahedron to the mid-Atlantic ridge, which weirdly it kind of almost fits, quite almost clicks into place. Suddenly everything fell into place using the geographic north poles as the poles, obviously. So the Russians were doing that throughout the 70s, and it was quite a big deal actually at the time in Russia. It got published in loads of scientific magazines. This was taken up by William Becker and Beth Hargens, professors in America, who have been in touch with a lot about this book to make sure I get all the facts correct in it. They've done a massive amount of research, been published in various different books and websites and so forth, and they kind of take it a step further and think that they kind of added a kind of infill for this icosahedron system, which later became what they call the unified vector geometry projection, which is the classic grid that everyone sees. It's like a flattened map. Everyone's seen it on the internet and different talks and so forth.
Mm.
And really, it's come from there. And I've just had a good look at all that research, really gone into it. And nowadays, you can even get on Google Earth, Beth Hargens has developed a grid program which you can just place on top of Google Earth.
Yes.
With all her things, all her lines in it, and it's amazing. I really recommend anyway. If you just type in Becker Hargens, Hagens, into Google, or Becker Hargens grid program, you can pick up a copy and get it. So there's a lot out there. And really, then we the rest of the book really goes into effects around the planet and patterns that they create around the planet, and looking at different geometries, and not necessarily specifically this exact grid that the other researchers have talked about, and how they relate to each other, distances between them, degrees of difference between them, different latitudes, longitudes, and really even at natural features like waterfalls, volcanoes, and mountains, and how they fit together. So there's a whole, we really went into it, and it's quite a fun little book really, kind of looking at all the different aspects, and quite a lot of new research there as well. And obviously we look at it from a geomantis perspective, where we're looking at these, what's called the Hartmann and the Curry grids, which
yes.
Cause geopathic stress, and they're very tight grids, very, very tight, just a few metres apart.
Yeah.
So we look at them as well and give an overview of that. So we're looking at, you know, all different grids really, we're not just saying there's only one. You know,
sure, sure.
There needs to be a whole different systems in place all across the planet.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, now you have quite a few websites out there. Tell us first, of course, how people would easily go about getting a copy of your book.
Well, the book's quite widely available. It's one of the wooden books, which there's, like, I don't know if anyone's heard of The Little Book of Coincidence or Robin Heath's books, Sun, Moon and Earth and Stonehenge. They're kind of everywhere. They're all around the world, really, especially in Britain, because that's where they're produced, Glastonbury. Get them on Amazon. You can get them. You better get them from my website or our website, which is avalonrising.co.uk. But generally, Amazon or books, they're in most bookshops nowadays. Hopefully, we're going to get it published worldwide as well. But I think we're just going to do it in Britain to see how it goes first. And obviously, you know, I'm doing lots of talks. But people can get them there. They're only a fiver as well, which is quite nice, you know.
Mm.
And you know, considering it's such a small book, there's a lot in it. It took us. It's quite weird how you put so much time into a book, and then people can read it in a couple of hours.
Right.
It's quite small. But again, you could, you know, it could easily be expanded into 10 times that size, which I'll probably do in the next year or two. So.
Sure, sure.
But they are quite widely available, the wooden books. Just look out for them. Yeah.
All right.
Launch here on the 27th in Glastonbury. People can drop in if they want it. Labyrinth Books on the High Street.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then, of course, you have a few other sites out there to your you know, Megalithomania and your Avalon magazine. Do you want to mention those as well?
Yeah, avalonrising.co.uk is where we do the magazine. That's the same thing. We produce our annual magazine, Earth Mysteries, lots of different subjects in that. Megalithomania is the conference we organise, myself and John Martineau and others, in Glastonbury every year, and we invite all the sort of top ancient mysteries, earth mysteries researchers, and, you know, even archaeologists and so forth. Next year we're doing it on May the 23rd and 24th in Glastonbury at the Assembly Rooms. We've got Graham Hancock and Robin Heath, amongst others. We do get sort of lesser known people who have done amazing research which will never get out there any other way, because they often don't publish books. But Michael Hodge is talking about ancient calendars. This guy Chris Proger is talking about how crystals were used in the megaliths, and that was a high technology. It's a very scientific way of looking at it, but what they're finding, you know, look at the way we use crystals now with the internet and telecommunications and technology. It's all there. It seems to be the ancients were doing it first.
Right.
And Christine Roan is looking at the sacred geography of ancient Greece. So we cover quite a range. And that's megalithomania.co.uk. And people, you know, we record all the talks. People can buy them on DVD for like £6 on the website, you know. David Hatch Childress was there last year. He was legendary, shall we say, and, amongst others.
Right, right. Okay, excellent. So there are a few websites there to check out. Again, I'm going to have these links up on the information page. So go there, and we'll have those links linked up easily for you to take a look at. But we're going to continue now with you, Newman, in our members section. So members, stay tuned for much more. We're going to tie together what we just talked about with seeds and fertility technology, going to a little bit more about crop circles maybe, and also about Giza and some of the pyramids there. And also, if there's time, spend a little bit time on the indigo children. We haven't talked about that too much on the program, so that might be a good idea to touch upon that. But stay with us, Hugh. We're going to continue our discussion in our member section. But for this segment, thank you very much for coming on. Great having you here.
Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate it.
Tune in to our second segment with Hugh Newman, now available in the member section. Go to redicecreations.com, click on subscribe and find out how to sign up, get instant access and tune in. And of course, don't miss our live show on Saturday the 4th with Daniel Tatman. That's going to be great. Just click on Red Eyes Live banner on our front page for time zones and times when we're going to begin. You'll also see the player there and more info. So we'll see you on Saturday, but right now, more coming up with Hugh Newman in the member section.